Hello, it's Tuesday, May 27th. This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Coming up on the podcast, Memorial Day speakers try to reassure veterans about their medical care. Farmers ready for lower corn prices. Minnesota looks to dusty, dry Arizona for water management tips. And we hear about a Twin Cities improv artist and the Timberwolves coach search. First, a report out today from a homeowners advocacy group says communities of color are lagging far behind majority white neighborhoods in recovering from the foreclosure crisis. Matt Sepik reports.
The Minnesota Home Ownership Center says the foreclosure crisis is largely over. The 12,000 foreclosures in Minnesota last year is the same number as in 2006, the first year of the crisis. In southwest Minneapolis, median sales prices have risen above 06 levels, but Julie Guggen, the center's executive director, says a typical homeowner in north Minneapolis who bought in 2007 would need to see a 70% increase in value to return to the original purchase price.
We do see that pattern of unequal recovery depending on neighborhood and, quite frankly, depending on race and ethnicity.
The report says in North Minneapolis, 34% of homeowners owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. In the southwest corner of the city, the report says 8% of homeowners are underwater. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The allegations of fraud and cover-up at several VA hospitals did not cast clouds over the Memorial Day observation at the Fort Snelling National Cemetery yesterday, but the scandal was on the minds of some who took part in the ceremony. Brant Williams reports.
The instant summer weather at Fort Snelling's annual ceremony made it feel more like July 4th than late May. Some guests and observers fanned themselves for relief from the humid 80-degree temperatures. A group of wool-uniformed Civil War reenactors portraying members of the 1st Minnesota Volunteer Infantry didn't falter or flinch as they stood in the heat, although one soldier did have to silence his cell phone during America the Beautiful. Speakers at today's ceremony honored the dedication and sacrifice of those who've died, but they also focused on the living, especially those veterans who get health care from the VA. Senator Amy Klobuchar referred in her remarks to allegations that a few VA hospitals have been covering up long wait times for veterans in need of treatment. She says it's wrong that soldiers returning from duty overseas should have to wait for health care.
When our soldiers signed up for service, there wasn't a waiting line. And when they come home to the United States of America, there should never be a waiting line in this country.
Senator Al Franken also indirectly referred to the scandal during his remarks.
When our veterans and our nation have our confidence in the VA system shaken, we must do everything we can to restore that trust and make sure that our veterans feel confident they are getting the best care possible.
The senators did not call for the resignation of VA Secretary Eric Shinseki. Both say they want more information about the allegations before they make a decision. The senators say they haven't seen anything similar to the Arizona VA hospital scandal in Minnesota. However, they've asked the head of Minnesota's VA system to investigate to make sure that's the case. A 2012 report from the Center for Investigative Reporting found that VA offices in Minnesota fared better than those in other states. However, the report found the shortest average wait time for a service member to get help on a disability claim was 100 days. Some family members of Minnesota veterans say the state system works pretty well. Pam Lynch of West St. Paul came to the cemetery for the ceremony and to visit the gravesite of her late husband, who was in the Navy during World War II.
I have a friend who goes to the VA here, and he's had wonderful service. And I think maybe, I like to think that this place here is a little, a notch above some of that other stuff that's going on.
Standing nearby, Tom and Ruth Olson from St. Anthony Village say their son is an Air Force retiree. Tom Olson says some of the problems at the Arizona hospital might be caused by the number of veterans it sees.
My son said that he heard that Lake Phoenix gets this influx of veterans, snowbirds.
Snowbirds.
And so all of a sudden every winter their volume goes up by 50% or something.
However, Tom's wife Ruth says it may be that Minnesota system just works better.
Yeah. Minnesota's just ahead of the game, and I don't think it's because, look around, I don't think it's because we got any less veterans up here.
The white headstones stretch in every direction for what seems like miles. There are more than 200,000 graves at Fort Snelling National Cemetery.
Brant Williams on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Minnesota grain farmers may be looking at a financial squeeze this year. The wet spring has ended drought for much of the Corn Belt, suggesting a big crop could be on the way. But that is helping drive down prices below the break-even point for a lot of producers. Here's Mark Stile.
As he gets his equipment ready to plant soybeans, farmer Michael Wojan says he's made good spring planting progress so far. One reason for that is because of the continued moderate drought conditions in the southwest corner of Minnesota. The dry weather is a concern, but on the plus side, it's also allowed farmers plenty of planting time in the fields. That's in contrast to much of the rest of Minnesota, where heavy rains have delayed field work. In some cases, there's been so much delay that farmers could miss key planting deadlines and risk losing some crop insurance benefits. But Wojan says despite the dryness on his farm some 100 miles southwest of the Twin Cities, he's still optimistic.
40-plus years of farming and I haven't lost a crop yet.
So far, he likes what he sees. He stops in a cornfield, gets down on his hands and knees, and digs up a corn seed that will become part of Minnesota's $5 billion corn crop. He's checking to see if the seed is ready to pop a new stalk out of the ground.
What's this? There we go. There you go. It's just really getting started. You've got that little shoot heading up and the root heading off down the side there.
That shoot should produce an ear of corn by fall, containing hundreds of kernels ready to be sold. Exactly what sort of price Wojan will get for that corn, though, is a big question. Commodity analyst Darren Newsom with DTN says it almost certainly will be nothing close to the record $8 a bushel price of a couple years ago. Newsom says if good weather produces a big U.S. crop, already low corn prices could go even lower.
We could see eventually corn futures drop down into the low $4 range and cash prices drop into the upper threes, and that would certainly get a lot of attention.
Much of the attention would come from farmers. Wells Fargo agricultural economist Michael Swanson says those sorts of low prices would spell big financial losses across farm country.
That's not going to be a real winner for a lot of producers.
In fact, Swanson says with similar prices last year, many farmers lost money on their corn. A team of academic researchers in Minnesota collect financial data each year from more than 1,000 farms in the state. Last year, they found low corn prices meant most farmers lost money on rented land, and about two-thirds of the acres in the data were rented. A sustained run of high corn prices has pushed up rents as landlords tried to capture some of the wealth their land was producing. But with grain prices on the downswing, those higher rents are growing red ink. Some especially hard-hit farmers lost more than $200 per rented acre last year. Swanson says especially for small farmers, a repeat of those losses again this year could push them to the economic brink.
It's just going to be a real tough decision. Can I get big enough to compete? Or do I have to exit the business?
Getting bigger could help because it would spread the costs of machinery and labor over more income-producing acres. But there's also risk in the strategy. It could mean even higher rental prices because the farmer would have to outbid others who are also eager to have more cropland.
Done!
As Windham area farmer Michael Wojan finishes working on his planting rig, he says even with the dry weather and the troubling outlook for corn, he's still happy to be farming. For one thing, the last few years have been good to him. Even though the outlook for corn is gloomy, Minnesota's $4 billion soybean crop should be profitable this year, offsetting some of the poor returns on corn. And even if things get really bad, Wojan says there are always non-financial benefits to his job.
There's a lot of satisfaction, too, in producing something from the ground and watching it grow.
For now, at least, the question of just how much money he makes off that crop will have to wait. Mark Stile, Minnesota Public Radio News, Cottonwood County.
Well, it's hard to believe in water-rich Minnesota, but experts say our current approach to our water supply is not sustainable. Thirsty farms, businesses, and neighborhoods are drawing down groundwater levels in parts of the state faster than they are being replenished. To help reverse that trend, it helps to look to the desert southwest. Cities like Tucson, Arizona, have been forced to adopt a water conservation ethic that some think Minnesota needs to adopt. Here's Dan Crocker.
In the 1970s, groundwater levels in Tucson were plummeting. The river flowing past downtown had dried up. And as the population surged, the city's water utility couldn't meet peak demand in the summer. Val Little, who was a spokeswoman for Tucson Water at the time, says customers were given a choice: either cut water use or pay for new wells and expensive pipelines.
And that was before anybody could spell conservation. I mean, nobody was talking about conservation anywhere.
Residents, she says, responded enthusiastically.
People began doing dishes at night. They began doing their laundry when they went to bed. People just curtailed their water use to a great degree.
Those changes in behavior staved off the need for new infrastructure. And current utility spokesman Fernando Molina says that new water-saving ethic stuck.
That's really what's unique about Tucson is you see a lot of communities react to shortages and you might see some changes happen. But once that drought goes away, people go back to their old customs and habits, and that never happened here.
And odd as it sounds, in the land of lakes, the state's residents could stand to learn from Tucson, says Ali El Hassan, water supply manager with the Metropolitan Council.
We are really water-rich, still water-rich state, but our use or our management strategies are unsustainable, and that's the thing we really need to be careful about.
El Hassan says the biggest challenge in a wet state like Minnesota is convincing people of the importance of conservation. Even in Tucson, mired in a decade-long drought, the water conservation ethic needs to be continually reinforced. Mary Pendergrass crunches across her Tucson front yard. No grass here for the medical school professor at the University of Arizona, just rocks, cacti, and some drought-resistant shrubs. But in back, it's an oasis with a small patch of grass, flowers, a grapefruit tree full of plump yellow fruit.
Ever since I've moved here, I have felt like a criminal for having this back here, but it's so nice.
That's where Eddie Lopez comes in. He's what's called a zanjero with Tucson Water, a kind of water cop. And he's here to help Pendergrass figure out ways to reduce her water use.
We never tell people, hey, get rid of your lawn. We don't tell people that. What we do tell them is, you know, when was the last time you set foot on the lawn in your front yard? It's probably when you're paying somebody to mow it. You put it on B here.
Lopez flips through the settings on Pendergrass's irrigation timer. It turns out she's watering it much more than she needs to.
I thought I had figured out that stupid irrigation system, and I haven't. Ah!
After spending 2 hours checking toilets, looking for leaks, examining her landscape irrigation, Lopez offers Pendergrass one main recommendation.
That grass, easily we can cut your grass watering in half to every other day, even in the summer.
That simple change, he says, will cut her water usage by about a third, 4,500 gallons per month.
I'm very happy to be advised to what to do.
For nearly 20 years, Tucson Water's zanjeros have educated customers, cajoled them, even occasionally made them feel guilty to cut their water use. And Tucson residents have responded. They've ripped out grass, installed super-efficient toilets, and are capturing rainwater and even wastewater from their washers and showers to irrigate their landscaping. As a result, Tucson's per capita water usage has shrunk by more than a third since the 1970s. Tucson has also done something a lot of communities are unwilling to do. It's jacked up the price of water. Tucson Water's Fernando Molina says the more water you use, the more you're charged for it.
So I tell people, it's like imagine going to a gas station, and the first 5 gallons are going to be maybe charged a little bit less than what the average price posted on the store is. But then you get to the next 5 gallons, and they're going to tack on an extra 50 cents a gallon, and then the next 5 gallons gets an extra $1 a gallon, and so that creates an incentive for you to drive a little more carefully.
The utility charges below the cost of service for a customer's first block of water, enough to cover basic needs like cooking and washing. Then, as customers use more discretionary water to fill up swimming pools or water lawns, the price jumps up to as much as 9 times the lowest rate.
So we'll start here at the uppermost portion of the land.
David Stevenson is one Tucson resident who does not need to worry about paying that highest rate for water. The IT developer lives with his son in what's almost a living laboratory for water conservation. Together, they use about 750 gallons of water a month. That's about 1/7 the average in Tucson and about 1/8 the national average.
As you notice, though, there's no lawns here at my house. There are no citrus gardens.
But he does have vegetable gardens, shrubs, and fruit trees, watered primarily by two huge silver cisterns that store 5,000 gallons of rainwater and by gray water left over from his shower, sink, and washing machine.
So this area is designed to be beautiful, therapeutic, grow food, but do so with as much low-water plants as possible.
While Tucson can't expect many residents to be as diehard as Stevenson, the city has adopted several ordinances designed to push people in that direction. Plumbing codes require water-efficient toilets and fixtures. Commercial landscaping laws limit plants that require a lot of water. Homeowners who install rainwater harvesting systems are eligible for a $2,000 rebate, and the list goes on. Ali El-Hassan with the Metropolitan Council says Minnesota should look to Tucson and other western towns for water conservation strategies that could work here. He says the place to start is our lawns, what he calls the biggest irrigated crop in the U.S.
It's the biggest user of our water. So you have 2 or 3 months that people are pumping all of this clean water, cities treating it, cleaning it, sending it to houses, and the houses are taking this water and putting it out in the lawn.
The scope of the challenge here could be measured by the fact that it's not unusual to see sprinklers spraying water when it's raining.
These are the things we really need to value our water more and more before we lose the ability to irrigate anything.
The advantage Minnesota has is that it's just starting out down this road towards smarter water use. The challenge facing Tucson now, says Sharon Megdahl, who directs the Water Resources Research Center at the University of Arizona, is that when it comes to conserving water, the city has already plucked much of the low-hanging fruit. She says Tucson now is looking ahead 40 or 50 years when population growth is expected to cause a gap between water supplies and demand.
Clearly, conservation is an important option. It's an important tool. It's one we use. But at the same time, almost everybody recognizes that conservation alone will not close the gap.
One way to close that impending gap is to reuse water, even after it's flushed down the toilet.
Dan Crocker in Arizona. Tomorrow, more on how Tucson is reusing its water. Despite its name, many people still believe improvisational comedy is scripted. It is not. And for Taj Ruler, it's about the truth, and that's what makes it so fulfilling. Nikki Tundell met up with the highly regarded Twin Cities improv artist to get her take on humor.
It's Monday night, and the basement classroom is full of characters. A disgruntled Beanie Baby collector, a water aerobics addict, and Mary Lou, Miss South Carolina 2004.
My special talent in our pageant was deep-sea fishing.
The personas are rich. They're also short-lived. That's the nature of improvisational acting. Everything's always in flux, says Taj Ruler, the actor leading this Minneapolis improv class.
Basically, improv to me is acting without a script. You don't know what's going to happen next.
Which is exactly what Ruler's students are learning. One minute, they're portraying Walmart security experts. The next, they're extending their chins out as far as they can. The exercise demonstrates how body positions can help shape a character's personality.
How does that change the way you walk? And most importantly, how does it change the way you feel?
There's a lot of times where people will be like, I want to be funny. People tell me I'm funny, so I just want to be funnier. I usually have to tell them, you know, I hate to burst your bubble, but every time you try to be funny, it's not funny.
The real goal, says Ruler, is to reflect truth. Not truth as in the opposite of a lie. Truth as in authenticity. Improv comedy isn't about creating the wackiest scene ever. It's developing details that ring true, while still being funny.
You are finding the truth in the moment with a character that you're presenting.
From the time she could talk, Ruler was committed to character development. The Minneapolis native would line up her stuffed animals and create distinctive voices for each and every one.
I would just play pretend for days. Sometimes I would have friends come over and I'd be like, you're interrupting my playtime. So...
Ruler grew up in an artistic family. She's the daughter of Jack Ruler, founder of Mixed Blood Theater. She studied at the London Dramatic Academy, then at famed comedy companies The Groundlings in Los Angeles and Second City in Chicago. With that kind of resume, people expect her to be funny, really funny, all the time, which can be overwhelming.
I'm actually quite shy, which a lot of people don't understand. Like, how can you be an introvert and a performer? And it's like, this is my job. It's what I love to do. And then I need to take some space for myself.
The 27-year-old might not be the type to crack up guests at a large dinner party, but when she takes the stage, she can captivate a crowd.
Zippity-boppity-boo!
Who are you?
I'm your fairy godmother! Surprise!
Ruler has performed at theaters throughout the Twin Cities. She's part of the Brave New Workshop's main stage cast and can be seen in the theater's latest offering, a pedal pub named Desire. The satirical sketch show examines the nuances of Minnesota culture.
Well, I suppose.
It includes scenes about love and rejection and a dating site called introvertsonly.com. Ruler wrote that one.
My ideal date is not being on a date.
The evening ends with improv. Sketches are prompted by audience pitches.
So the suggestion we got for this first thing is driving a horse-drawn carriage.
This is a moment that is being created right now. Not to sound really cheesy, but it's kind of magical in that sense.
With no script to rely on and no idea where others might take the storyline, improvisers have to connect.
I like that you have to be present. Like, there's no way you can just kind of check out. You have to be there. I love that you can be there with somebody else. They hopefully will be supporting you. You are supporting them, and that's what I love about it.
And having the freedom to play everyone from a llama jockey to a woman with a vengeful, human-sized cat doesn't hurt either.
Thanks so much for coming out. Have a great night!
Nikki Tundell, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And we close out the NPR News Update with a look at the Timberwolves and their search for a leader. The team is still looking for a new head basketball coach after its first choice decided he did not want the job. Howard Sinker, a digital sports editor for the Star Tribune, talked about it with Kathy Werzer.
I understand that Memphis Grizzlies head coach Dave Yeager had a good year in his first season coaching that team. So why was he considering the T-Wolves job?
Well, as crazy as things are with the Timberwolves, the Memphis situation was a little bit messed up, too. They have a fairly new owner, a software billionaire named Robert Pera, who apparently wasn't fond of Yeager for one reason or another. He wasn't fond of others on his staff. He basically purged parts of his front office, and somewhere along the line, he gave Yeager permission to interview with the Timberwolves. And one of the theories is that he was really willing to let him go, but they couldn't agree on compensation in the form of what kind of trade would you work out in order to let him coach the Timberwolves. It would have involved draft choices. Then the spin on it went that the two of them actually had their first conversation ever, and they sweetened Yeager's contract, and Pera decided, hey, this guy isn't so bad after all. But I don't think we're ever going to know the entire truth on this one.
No, it sounds like a bit of a mess, really. So,
but given the Timberwolves, this is just this is almost business as usual with what you'd expect for the local basketball franchise.
No, not good. So who are the leading candidates now that Yeager is out of the picture?
Well, people are talking about Sam Mitchell, the former Timberwolves forward who's had a couple of coaching opportunities, and Lionel Hollins, who coached the Grizzlies before Yeager did. I still think this is going to end up, despite all the talk to the in the other direction, that Flip Saunders, the team president, is going to end up coaching the team. He really wants to coach. At some point, he's still going to have to convince Glenn Taylor, the owner, that he's the best available candidate. But I just really think that's how it's going to turn out.
Well, that wouldn't be a bad choice, would it?
It wouldn't be a bad choice, but it really turns one person into the entire power structure almost of the front office. And when you think about, okay, you know, how many voices do you want to have weigh in on personnel matters, on trades, on all of the things that need to be done to run an NBA franchise, I think that the prevailing wisdom is that if you have several good voices, you're in better shape than if you consolidate all that power in one person.
Why is it so hard to find a head coach for the Timberwolves?
Well, would you want to coach the Timberwolves, Kathy?
I don't.
This is a team
good
that
point.
There have been two kinds of bad things that have happened. There's been bad fortune, but there's also been a history of bad decisions. It's just not an organization that, despite Flip Saunders' recent presence, has a very good track record and would be attractive to someone who might want to make them name for themselves as a coach. They saw Rick Adelman come in and not be able to get them into the playoffs. there are better opportunities for those who are patient.
All right, so stay tuned.
Absolutely. It's a drama worth following.
Howard Sinker and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition and the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for coming along today. Minnesota's News for a Wednesday, right back here tomorrow.